We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right.
Maria's been into the eggnog again, by the way.
No.
Okay. Well,
no, I don't do dairy.
She couldn't have done it here because there wasn't
well, she,
anyone
she,
got
she like took the dairy out and left the important parts in.
Well, yeah.
All right. All right. Starting out with local, and we should note that we're going to be going to a regular feature that we do this time of year. Later, the overhyped and underreported stories for the year.
17th year in a row, the most overhyped stories of the year and then the most underreported stories of the year. And we're doing local stories this week. So for anybody that Tim Harris didn't diss in the 7:30 hour, don't worry. We'll
be touching on that later.
We'll get to you, yeah.
Okay. So, but before that, we're going to cover a few stories that popped up this week. The first one being some more hats in the ring for the mayor's race.
Yeah, we're up to five people now who've either announced exploratory committees or formally announced that they're running for mayor next year. In addition to the incumbent, Mike McGinn, and City Council member Tim Burgess, and State Senate Majority, Minority Leader Ed Murray. We also had this week former city council, I believe he was president at one point, Peter Steinbrück. He certainly served several terms on city council. And then Kate Martin, the former president of the Greenwood Community Council. And Martin said something very interesting in her announcement. She said something that nobody else has been willing to say, that the police chief of SPD should be fired, and that, in fact, SPD is a problem. Martin actually could bring quite a bit to the race. He's also the only woman facing four men who are all very well-funded and have won elections in the past. But because it's an unusually strong field this year compared to mayoral races in past years, she's going to have a hard time being heard, and that's a shame because conventional wisdom is not the only thing that needs to be heard in the race next year.
All right. Moving on to the state level, Senator Ed Murray having a new plan this week.
Yeah, State Senator Ed Murray, who after the election would have gone in as the Senate Majority Leader because the Democrats had a majority in the Senate.
26-23.
Yeah, and after the election, two Democratic senators, very conservative Democratic senators, Rodney Tom of Bellevue and Tim Sheldon of Potlatch, decided they were going to caucus with the Republicans and vote with them instead of with the Democrats, and that will give the Republicans the majority. However, Senator Rodney Tom, as an inducement to get him to switch sides, he was the Republicans said, well, if you come over to our caucus, we will make you the majority leader. He put forth a proposal last week or the week before, somewhere around in there, saying, let's share committee assignments. Let's share committee chairs in the Senate. So we'll give some to the Democrats, the unimportant committees, and we'll reserve the important committees for the Republicans. And then
spoken like a true loyal Democrat.
Oh, yes. And then he said, well, what do you think to the Democrats? And Ed Murray, who is now the minority leader in the Senate of the Democrats, he came back and said, no, I'm sorry, we can't do that. That's not the way the Senate rules operate. And if you guys want to change the rules, go ahead. Sit down in your one vote majority caucus and pass some rule changes, and then we'll see. So it's kind of heartening to see Ed Murray, the now minority leader.
Yeah,
in
he's
the
actually
Senate,
he's actually technically actually technically majority leader
until the
legislature convenes on, I believe, the 7th, a week from next Monday, or actually 2 weeks from this coming Monday, and at that point they will vote for majority leader.
They will have
and
to.
The Republicans will have the majority with Tom and Sheldon voting with them.
Yeah, and they will have to, if they want to put forth their plan where they share committee assignments, they'll have to vote on that when the legislature convenes.
Yeah, and meanwhile, we've heard a lot of talk this week, particularly in the wake of the massacre in Newtown a week ago yesterday, about gun control legislation in this state, and that's a really good example of the implications of two guys who were elected as Democrats turning over control of the state Senate to the Republicans. and what that will mean for the state of Washington. Because, you know, Tom, incidentally, in his bulk mailings to his constituents is saying, I helped form a bipartisan majority in the Senate, which, you know, can we please save the term bipartisan for when a majority of each caucus signs on to something, not when one member of a party provides cover for the entire partisan agenda of the other party.
Two members, one of them having been a Republican at one point before he switched to Democrat and has now switched back, and that's Tom.
And Tim Sheldon, who's been sort of notorious as a Republican in Democrats' clothing for many, many years.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you look at the committee in the Senate that has jurisdiction over possible gun safety and regulation laws. And, under the Republicans, it's going to be chaired by a guy from Spokane Valley who, was rated A+ in his reelection campaign this year by, the NRA. And in committee after committee, that's who's going to control which bills get hearings, which bills get voted upon. This is, you know, this is not the Dan Evans GOP anymore, unlike what a lot of local media and a lot of local pundits would like to pretend. The Washington State Republican Party is just as radical and just as crazy as the national folks are. And so, you know, having these folks, even if Rodney Tom is you know, by modern standards, a very moderate Republican, passing himself off as a Democrat, now caucusing with the Republicans. You know, he's empowering a bunch of people who are not. And from what I'm hearing, when he is up for re-election on the East Side, he is going to face a primary challenge. That is already pretty much certain.
Yeah.
All right. On to national then, and the supposed fiscal cliff talks with John Boehner.
Boehner, actually. Boehner. And yes, it's a gentle fiscal incline, which we are rapidly approaching. And we've talked about that before on this program, how the whole sort of scare tactics of this horrible precipice that we're about to go plunging over justifies the need to, you know, increase the retirement age and gut Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and so forth. Well, the Obama administration, to its somewhat surprising credit so far, has not backed down on its insistence that wealthier people get taxed and some revenue get raised. And
Obama raised the limit from $250,000 to $400,000, and then he talked about changing the way Social Security cost of living increases were calculated, which would be a cut.
I was just about to get to that. But in any event, that's the plan that he has most recently put on the table. The Republicans, of course, rejected that. And so Boehner, to try the House Majority Leader, to try and put pressure on Obama, put what he called the Plan B. No, this is not the contraceptive. Republicans don't believe in contraceptives. Put a proposal on which had some very token closings of loopholes on the very wealthy, but wouldn't actually cost them a whole lot more. But at least in name be. You know, increasing taxes on the wealthy.
People who make more than a million.
Yes, people who make more than a million. And, you know, in exchange for, you know, gutting everything else. And he could not deliver the votes of his own caucus and abruptly withdrew his proposal for just before it was ready to go to the floor for a vote. This tells us a couple things. Number one, the fiscal cliff and sequestration are going to happen, and the Bush tax cuts are going to expire at the end of the year. And there will have to be a retroactive fix to that, which almost certainly will happen at some point in 2013. But beyond that, probably more importantly for the long term, it tells us that nobody's in charge of the short bus that is the National Republican Party. You know, Boehner cannot control his own caucus. There's a bunch of these little atomized constituencies, most of them beholden to large corporations and mobilizing the base in one form or another of fear mongering. And you know, these people in Congress, the ones who actually are sane, are so terrified of getting primaried by people who aren't. That it's more or less indistinguishable in how they vote. And, it's, you know, there's nobody for the White House and for Obama to cut a deal with, even though he is inclined to cut a bad deal. There's nobody to negotiate with. And so it's going to be very, very difficult until the composition of the House has changed, hopefully in 2014, for anything really to get through Congress.
On the other hand, it's kind of heartening to see that, the way it's going right now, it looks like the Bush-era tax cuts are going to expire. And I've argued all along that that should happen because most of the tax cuts were for people who make a lot of money, not for the poor and not for the middle class. And that, in fact, when the tax cuts expire, people are not going to see a big increase in their most people are not going to see a big increase in their taxes. So this idea of a fiscal cliff isn't going to be that meaningful for most people unless, of course, you make a lot of money.
It's the sequestration that I think is more of a
concern. It's the sequestration that's more of a problem because it's going to force automatic cuts in all government programs. Although, just before Boehner took his vote on, asked his party in the Senate to count up the votes for Plan B. To count up the votes for Plan B. They passed a bill to support, not allowing automatic cuts to the defense budget. But pushing them all over into the domestic spending,
which the Republicans have been advocating for some time.
Yes, and of course that passed the House, but will never pass the Senate. So the real fiscal cliff here is going to be what happens to the federal budget, particularly for domestic programs.
All right, a new foundation out this week.
Yeah, there's a new foundation for folks who are out there trying to decide where you want to make your year-end donations to. It's called the Freedom of the Press Foundation. And it was set up by Daniel Ellsberg, Glenn Greenwald, John Perry Barlow, who's a co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, John Cusack, the actor, and several other folks who are interested in supporting groups that are trying to do active journalism that holds the government's feet to the fire when it comes to secrecy laws and some of the underhanded and internationally illegal things that our own government is doing. Back in December of 2010, and they came up with this foundation because they thought groups like WikiLeaks, another group that they support is the National Security Archive, which stores a lot of the declassified documents that the government releases for journalists and other folks to access. They realized that these organizations have a tough time getting funding. In WikiLeaks' case, in particular, in December of 2010, Visa, MasterCard, and PayPal announced that they would no longer process transactions that go directly to WikiLeaks.
Under heavy pressure from the U.S. government, even though WikiLeaks had not been accused of, let alone indicted of, or convicted of any crimes.
Of any crimes at all. And that has cut off about 95% of WikiLeaks' funding. So this new foundation, Freedom of the Press Foundation, they are taking donations for not just WikiLeaks, but other Freedom of the Press type organizations. And you can go on their website now. You can make a donation. You can specify which organizations you want your money to go to, or you can make the donation directly to help the Freedom of the Press Foundation do their work. That URL is pressfreedomfoundation.org.
So if you were nervous about donating to WikiLeaks prior, this is a way of routing around that.
Yeah, it's tax deductible. So.
All right. Always a concern for some at the end of the year.
Yes.
All right. Let's, with that then, I guess we are moving on to the overhyped and underreported stories.
Yes. And the overhyped ones we generally tend to go through very quickly because, frankly, you've already heard more than you want to hear about some of them. Yeah. And these are local stories. We'll get to the national and international in the next week or two. Newsflash, the Sonics are not about to come back to Seattle. We had this massive campaign to sell the idea of a new arena, which taxpayers are somewhat on the hook for. Not entirely, which is good, but still, substantially. And it was largely predicated on the idea that, well, we'll bring in teams for the NBA and NHL. Well, it's not that simple.
Yeah.
In either league, teams very rarely move. There are several other cities for each league that are looking for teams from those leagues. There just aren't that many candidates, and certainly there have been no, and I've said this on this program before, there have been no cities in the history of North American men's team sports that have attracted teams from two different leagues in more or less the same time frame. Seattle is not that special and not that different, and it won't either. And because of that, we're going to get stuck with more of the costs than are being projected now.
Yeah, sports news in general tended to dominate the coverage, news coverage locally in the Times, on the Times website, in the Times newspaper. It's the one section of the Times newspaper that's probably a revenue generator for them. The PI website, if you go on there, the news feed, even the Associated Press news feed, just dominated by sports news. And, hey, you know, guess what? That really isn't news. It's more of a hobby. Let's put it
where
it belongs.
Well, it's entertainment news, but yeah. It is not to be confused with, you know,
real
things
news
that will actually affect your life. No.
Yeah. Also overhyped this year was the mayor's 2020 plan for police reform. Turns out it was a 20-point plan with really only one point, and that one point is to provide PR for the police department.
Yeah, it's a 20-point PR
exercise.
It's a press release. And it was a widely lauded press release and a really cool press release because it was disguised as a policy document. But and incidentally, most of that document, as of the last time anybody checked, has not yet been implemented. So even
no.
even the very vague and inconsequential reforms that it listed have been ignored by SPD. And speaking of sports coverage, another staple of local coverage, Microsoft, home of lousy software, this year it's Windows 8 that all the trades are panning and that all the local media is glorifying
yeah.
and fawning over.
And the Surface tablet, which is the local media is so happy about, but pretty much everybody in the tech world is saying it's a dog.
Yeah. And, you know, the usual car crashes, fires, violent and potentially violent crimes, big or not weather events, heartwarming stories of photogenic plucky kids overcoming adversity or reuniting with their pets, and every other staple of Chuckle Buddy TV news. TV news just makes you stupider. It's been studied. It's true. And then one last overhyped thing, the banning of plastic bags. Plastic bags,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Took effect on July 1st. And, oddly enough, much as with the Mayan apocalypse, civilization has not ended. People just adjusted just fine.
Yep.
All right. How about the underreported?
Yeah, McGinn and the city of Seattle still in deep denial about the SPD. We see them still digging in their heels and fighting every step of the way as the new DOJ moderator is getting into, as the new DOJ reforms are getting into place, and the new guy is in there trying to get them to make changes. At the same time, the SPD's been rolling out its new aerial drones program, and it's flying completely under the radar as the news is focusing more on the DOJ reforms and how much the SPD is trying to help make changes when in fact they're really still dragging their feet.
You did drones flying under
yes,
the radar with a very straight face. That was very good.
Yes, I know.
And the other thing I would put in under law enforcement is that while SPD is being a mess, there's been almost no local media attention given to the King County Sheriff's Office, and they have had a very bad year as well. There was a lawsuit by former King County Sheriff's Office deputies and employees alleging rampant sexual harassment within the organization. The county auditor has issued a hugely critical report of how it's run and same sorts of issues around.
Yeah, that the county sheriff's office doesn't document and investigate civilian complaints, particularly on use of force issues.
Yeah, use of force and also disproportionate targeting of non-white populations. And then the county's jails also continue to be a scandal and a mess in any number of respects. So it's not just SPD that's a problem locally.
Yeah, and it makes you wonder, maybe the state patrol might have some issues, too, that nobody's looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Also this year, the legislature came out with its Supreme Court came out with its McCleary decision, saying the legislature has not adequately funded education in the state of Washington. And what was the legislature's response? Well, let's slow the budget cuts slightly, but let's continue to cut funding for K-12. And now, just this week, the state Supreme Court, after hearing reports from the state, came back and said, hey, we are serious here, guys. This is our new ruling. You got to get your act together or else, you know, it's not sufficient to just slow the cuts. That's not real progress. You have to put more money into K-12 education.
Yeah, it's very reminiscent at the congressional level when they talk about defense cuts and future budgets. What they're talking about is reductions in the rate of growth.
Yeah.
And it's exactly the opposite in Olympia. When they're talking about increasing education spending, what they're talking about is decreasing the rate of cuts.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty telling indictment on both sides of the equation as to what our social priorities are. Meanwhile, in transportation issues, there have been a number of interesting things this year. The tolls for the tunnel that replaced the Alaska Way Viaduct downtown, or will replace it, keep dropping because opponents of the tunnel kept saying before and after it had been decided upon that people wouldn't pay money to go under downtown like that. Well, sure enough, the commission that's in charge of setting the rates keeps running the models and running the studies and finding out that, no, if we charge that much for a toll, all the traffic will just spill out onto the surface streets downtown. No, if we reduce it to that, they'll still go downtown. And what they're basically coming to the conclusion of is that there really is no toll that's too low that will avoid downtown from being gridlocked. So that's your $4.3 and counting billion-dollar tunnel.
Which made everybody wonder, why the heck didn't we just go with surface street improvements in the first place? Why are we even doing the tunnel?
And that's that's because it's a real estate development project and not a transportation project. Speaking
of unnecessary transportation projects, the Mercer mess.
Speaking of real estate redevelopment projects.
Yeah, the city spent hundreds of millions of dollars cleaning up the Mercer mess. And after spending those millions to beautify the Paul Allen corridor in South Lake Union, what we have is higher property values in South Lake Union and a street that is still a traffic nightmare. It did not improve travel times along Mercer, and it has not helped traffic in the corridor as a whole.
And speaking of something that didn't improve travel times, eliminating the ride-free zone has been something of a nightmare and continues
Metro.
To be something of a nightmare for the local bus system. They're still trying to work out why exactly it is that it takes so much longer now to get from one end of downtown to the other. It does. How about that?
It does. And, you know, the eliminating the ride-free zone has just completely messed up travel times, particularly through the tunnel. And also another problem at Metro is that their new rapid ride program has turned into the crowded ride program because the new rapid ride routes have replaced multiple bus routes. So, in fact, the rapid ride is not additional bus service. It really is amounted to cuts in bus service for those corridors.
Yeah, but fortunately the streetcars will fix everything.
Yeah, and there were some housing things too that didn't get a whole lot of attention from the city. One of them was a massive increase in rents in the city. That to the average rent inside the city of Seattle now is over $1,600, up around close to $1,700 a month, and that vacancy rates hover around 2%. This is for a lot of reasons, none of which you'll see in the local media, one of which is the massive conversion of older housing stock into condos during the housing boom. And now that we need all those rents because people are getting kicked out of their condos because of all of the foreclosures, now that we need more rental space, developers are stepping in and building what are called market rate apartments, which, as it turns out, are not affordable. They're basically calculations the developers make in what the market will bear. So they've raised rents all across the board.
And they're getting a big assist from the city of Seattle. Witness the very behind-closed-doors decision, later ratified in spite of the public hearings that were held as window dressing, to massively redevelop Yesler Terrace, and not just redevelop it, the public housing tract owned by the Seattle Housing Authority, meant to serve the poorest of the poor, but happens to have nice view properties of downtown in Elliott Bay. And so, therefore, they're going to redevelop it, go from 500-some housing units to over 5,000, but actually reduce the number of on-site units that are dedicated to the poorest of the poor. Half of the land is going to be sold at deep discount to developers for office space and market rate housing. And then SHU will be doing its own market rate housing as well. Setting aside a little bit of their housing stock, some of which will actually be moved off site for the population that they're allegedly supposed to be primarily, actually entirely serving.
Yeah. And meanwhile, an audit of Seattle's multifamily tax exemption, that is tax breaks for developers to build affordable housing, showed widespread cheating by developers and almost no enforcement of the law by the city. So I'm not surprised at what happened at Yesler Terrace.
Yeah. Meantime, we have some other stories also. It was a busy year, 2012 was.
Locally.
Something that got almost no media attention outside of, you know, local internet blogs and whatnot. The criminalization of protests. There was a very widely hyped spree of minor vandalism that happened around May Day protests on May 1st this year, but that was used to justify an already existing federal grand jury that was convened in March to look into Occupy activists in Seattle and the Pacific Northwest. Houses have been raided in Portland and Olympia and Seattle. One in Seattle that was particularly amusing, they raided a house full of Maoist activists looking for anarchist materials, which, you know, aside from the fact that there's nothing illegal about anarchist materials, they were looking in the wrong place.
Very much the wrong place.
But more importantly, there are now four and I believe about to be five people who are sitting rotting in federal jail down in SeaTac on contempt of court charges for refusing to testify before that secret grand jury about their friends and their activities, even though nobody's actually said any of those activities were anything other than legal protest. So, you know, this is the sort of chilling effect on dissent and protest that ought to be getting a lot of attention, but is not.
Yeah, the latest person, I believe, will be on December 26th.
That's correct. Yeah.
If he goes to jail.
Merry Christmas.
Other items?
Yeah.
We've got about 3 minutes left.
With all the talk about the arena and all the back and forth about whether the city should and the county should throw money into it and support it, we found out that the real reason, once the super secret financial plan for the arena was released, we found out the real reason why Chris Hansen, the hedge fund billionaire, wants our money for the new arena. It's so he can get a cheaper loan with lower interest rates. Here's a guy who could fund the construction of the arena out of pocket if he wanted to.
He could pretty much fund the Washington State budget out of pocket.
But he's not going to. He's not going to put any of his assets on the table. He set up what they called a thicket of limited liability companies. This is the Seattle Times said that. A thicket of limited liability companies that will protect his assets and any of the other partners in the case. And in case the arena doesn't make money and has to go under, he'll be protected. But what he wants is the city and the county to throw in some money so that he can go to a bank and say, look, I have public support for this. Can I get an ultra cheap loan with ultra low interest rates?
And guess who might wind up holding the bag if in fact it does go south?
It's going to be the city and the county.
Yep. And we also have an interesting dynamic in the election this past year in terms of statewide initiatives, where Tim Iman got I-1185 passed. That was his latest round of requiring the legislature to had a two-thirds vote for any tax or fee increases, which basically makes any new revenue for the state impossible. Even though a court earlier in the year ruled that that was unconstitutional, and that is now pending before the state Supreme Court. Not only did that not disqualify Iman's ballot initiative from going to voters in November, but it wasn't even really raised in the campaign as, by the way, this is blatantly unconstitutional. It's not only crippling our state finances and gutting absolutely essential education and social programs,
and but it's also spending.
It's also total and infrastructure. It's also totally illegal. So that didn't get any attention. And then maybe last but least, we had Seattle Archbishop Peter Sartain making national news this year for helping the Catholic hierarchy's war on women and gays, both by brazenly and outspokenly opposing R-74, and then also heading the task force that was trying to clamp down on the national group of nuns that the Vatican didn't approve of. But, you know, all of this was being done while conveniently forgetting that Sardine came here in 2010 on the heels of his involvement in promoting ordaining and promoting a priest just before that priest was convicted convicted of 5 years running of pedophilia. So he was involved in that whole mess within the Catholic Church, was promoted after his promotion of somebody involved in that, and now he's coming out as a moral arbiter of what other people should and shouldn't be doing, and nobody's calling him on the hypocrisy.
Talking as we do every week. Hello. With John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both
Speaking
beneath
of
the state.
Eggnog.
Yeah, we needed to.
Yeah, I think Mike was the one who got the egg.
Tell people where they can find Eat the State.
www.eatthestate.org. And next week we will have the articles posted with all the different local and national and international overhyped and underreported stories of the week. And oh, by the way, happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.